Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it. Today, we have possibly the most anticipated show I've ever done with ESI Bytes, at least from my perspective. We're going to try to understand and offer some coaching on the judicial perspective on concept searching and predictive coding. I'm pleased we're bringing together two of the most acclaimed judges in eDiscovery, Judges Facciola and Grimm, who are the keynote speakers at almost every conference they attend for good reason. The Honorable Paul Grimm serves as a full-time magistrate judge for the United States District Court for the District of Maryland. He was appointed in February of 1997, and the Honorable John Facciola is a U.S. Magistrate Judge for the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. They both invested the time to learn this space, write some of the most widely cited opinions in the field, and they're both willing to tell anyone who will listen what they think to try and advance the field. In addition, we've included Maura Grossman, who's counsel at Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz, who also oversees eDiscovery at that firm. Maura also is co-coordinator of the TREC legal track, which is studying the effectiveness of advanced search technology in the eDiscovery context. For those unaware, TREC is a federally funded program to study search and retrieval approaches, and Maura often has some of the best neutral data to assess a variety of eDiscovery tools and approaches. And lastly, we've added Chris Dale, a former attorney and then technologist from the United Kingdom, who's the leading blogger on eDiscovery in the UK and speaks all over the world on eDiscovery, including using new technologies to make litigation more efficient. Because Chris works on another continent, he adds a level of neutrality to the discussion which can't hurt. So why are we doing this show? Last fall, an eDiscovery Institute study analyzed 11 separate companies' white papers on using predictive or suggestive coding and clustering techniques and found, on average, 45% cost savings, ranging from between 23% and 73% using these tools versus the current brute force review method where bodies are thrown at data and everything is reviewed. The same study also added that the reason these tools are not widely adopted is a fear on the part of lawyers on whether they are defensible. I can corroborate this study as I work in this specific space in eDiscovery, and I hear this from almost everyone I talk to hundreds of times over the past year. What is worse is most of the people who I talk to are the eDiscovery lawyers or lit support personnel at law firms, and they really want to use these tools. Unfortunately, they're often outgunned even at their own firms by the majority of litigators who won't learn new tricks until they have to or are concerned. So it's easy to play the defensibility card, and frankly, judges have little knowledge about technology. As a result, I've spent some time training judges in the Western District of Pennsylvania and Southern District of New York on some of these tools with Maura's assistance. This ESI Byte show is part of this training program because it reaches a wider audience more quickly. What I'm hoping for is, even if we don't get the decision from the judges that lawyers are asking for, we can at least ask for a few smoke signals that it's all right to try and improve the industry. Because one thing is very clear. No one is defending the status quo of keyword searching or keyword gambling, as I like to call it, followed by brute force linear review, that it's cost effective or even delivers quality results. Yet still the legal profession can't seem to find the intestinal fortitude to push the field towards improving itself. So enough of me on the soapbox. Let's start the program. First, let's start with some definitions. Chris, would you care to define clustering techniques and maybe what some of the possible advantages these technologies offer?
The main point about clustering is that it decides for itself and how to group documents together in a way that brings them all under one eye. It's not a matter of learning at this stage. That's something we'll come on. Of system learning, that's something we'll come on to. There was a definition that Attenex used to have some time ago. Documents define themselves and find their friends, which I think is a useful picture of what clustering involves. But the difference between litigation support searching and most other searching is that often you haven't got a clue what's in there. And to have a system group things together for you is an immensely helpful starting point.
And Maura, can you talk a little bit about predictive or suggestive coding? Because that's different from clustering.
Yes, it is different, and often people confuse the two under the kind of umbrella term of concept search. Predictive coding is using machine learning technologies to categorize an entire collection of documents as either responsive or non-responsive based on a human reviewing only a small subset of the document collection. So these tools typically rank the documents from most to least likely to be responsive to a specific information request. That ranking can be then used to cut or partition the documents into one or more categories, such as potentially responsive or not, in need of further review or not, and so forth. And if you want to think of a good analogy, the best one I can think of is a spam filter. It reviews and classifies emails into ham, spam, and maybe questionable documents. And as far as types of machine learning, there are two types. Supervised learning is where a human being chooses the document exemplars, what we'll call a seed set, and feeds it to the system and requests that the system ranks the remaining documents in the collection according to their similarity to or difference from the exemplars. So it's essentially a find me more like this and or find me ones that aren't like this. In active learning, the system chooses the document exemplars and then feeds it to a human and requests that the human make the responsive determination from which the system then learns and applies that learning to the remaining documents in the collection.
Okay. First Judge Grimm and then Judge Facciola, have either of you seen a case where keyword searching is used where the parties have come to you and said, boy, this is really working well? In contrast, that's cases where you've seen people complain about it.
This is Paul Grimm. My experience has been that keyword searching, when it comes up in terms of the parties coming back and giving you some sort of an input about what's going on, is either that they're having difficulty with getting terms that are identified such that you can have a small enough response to the keyword search to bring about the cost savings that have been that are being attempted by using keyword searching. And so you generally always get the difficulties if you get anything rather than this worked out very well.
Okay, and Judge Facciola?
I agree with Paul. I think that the problem is that there is nothing in a lawyer's experience prior to confronting this that would suggest to him that there would be another way of doing this. That is, he has used Lexis, he has used Westlaw, and he's used Google, I suppose, to find a good Chinese restaurant in San Francisco. And he's put all that experience together, and therefore when it is proposed that we take X number of custodians and we look for keywords, that it will probably work. Has it worked? Paul and I would not have written the opinions we did, indicating that it requires a sophisticated expertise to use it well if it was working perfectly. But I don't think there are too many lawyers or judges who have been put in a position where they have been forced to learn that there is an alternative and how to use it. So this is, I'm sure, to them, a very arcane and inexplicable area where they're not too willing to go into without an extraordinary amount of technical guidance from an IT expert that they have retained.
Carl, this is Paul Grimm again.
Yes.
I want to just say that, like he did in his Ashcroft case at the very Judge Facciola has been the one to remind us all in his O'Keefe decision and the companion decision to that about the technical aspect of these and why it's important for lawyers to have the competence to understand sort of what they're doing. I want to just give sort of an encouragement to the type of information and type of approach that concept searching and searching in a paradigm that is more more satisfactory and robust than keyword searching get the kind of new look and support that it can. And just simply say that if there's anything that we've learned from the experience of new evidence rule 502, the advisory note, is that rule was adopted to give a comfort factor to lawyers and judges that if you experiment with electronic and computer implemented search methodology, that is by itself an example of what is reasonable. And I think what has to happen is, and I'm interested in John's observations as well, is that you've got to overcome that comfort inertia that exists, because it's taken a long time for lawyers just to, I use the words, a key search as something that is a tool that they can use, however imperfect it is. And the lawyers and the judges haven't gotten it through their heads that the experimentation out there encourages the use of other techniques. And I think part of it is because there is this perception, which Maura can tell you, and I'm sure Chris can say as well, is absolutely, and you, Carl, is absolutely incorrect, that the gold standard, quote-unquote, of eyeballs on documents produces a better result. And when you look at the cases under Rule 502 of mistakes where things have inadvertently come in, it is oftentimes the case when there has been eyeballs on discovery, which is viewed as the gold standard. And as Maura can tell you, and as she will tell us all in a soon-to-be-published law review article that I've been blessed to see a copy of in draft form, which is excellent, is that the Trek experience is starting to show that even that the emergence of other search methodology beyond keywords is starting to have far better recall and precision rates than eyeball searching is, and that the myth of lawyer or paralegal review producing a better result, that I think has already been shattered. It's just a matter, as John says, of getting people to recognize that and to realize that they now have tacit permission in Rule 502 to undertake these experimentations and that they need to.
Great. A quick question about clustering, Judge Grimm. You know, clustering is basically just sorting data and grouping it together. Does sorting by itself create any defensibility issues? You can still look at everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is almost too narrow a question to focus on what I think is the approach that ought to be taken, that lawyers should be considering, and that courts, I think, would be willing to consider. And that is, start off with what John Fasciola told us all in O'Keefe. This is technical stuff. You have to start from a technical area with people who have the knowledge of how do you sort electronically, whether it's clustering or keywords or whatever, Boolean searches or whatever it may, concept searching, whatever it may be called. How do you design something that will go into this volume of data and without having eyeballs on so that the cost is up there, pull it out in a way that allows us to deal with the recall, which is how complete is it, and precision, which is how accurate is it. And when you can come up with an answer that tells you how you can have those two twin objectives, the acceptable recall, acceptable precision, then if that includes sorting, then that's what you ought to try and argue. And it seems to me that the way this may have to get started is by the lawyer who knows that this methodology works and has the technical way to explain it to the court, wants to try it and is getting resistance from an adversary, that's the time that the lawyer who knows it can work should file a motion with the court asking the court to have a hearing to be able to demonstrate this and get the a priori permission of the court to be able to do it. Once that happens and you get that first opinion, and the question is whether John Fasciola gets the writer or whether Paul Grimm gets the writer or one of our other colleagues, there are judges out there waiting for that opportunity to make a principled ruling, and once you get that first decision, I think it follows from there. So if you can show that sorting is one that is going to get you from how do we get from this enormous volume of information in a technically defensible, principled way to be able to be responsive to legitimate discovery while keeping costs down, then you're going to sell it. But you have to be able to undertake, as John told us all and O'Keefe, you've got to be able to undertake the demonstration that the technical approach you're using has reliability.
And I'll just add one thing on that. When you look at clustering, one of the things that can happen is you tend to see where a word that might appear relevant when it appears in other clusters that are less relevant, you can see where the false positives come from. And that's one of the things that people seem to like about clustering. But there's a boogeyman in the clustering, and I want to ask Judge Fasciola about that. You know, if if you're using keywords, you find what you find. But when you use clusters, sometimes you'll find documents which don't have the keywords, which might be requested by the other party, but clearly are relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any ethical issues raised there? And do you think those documents need to be provided?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, if the request for production of documents demands a certain sort of information, and by virtue of the clustering, you find that document, then you turn it over. The fact that your opponent proposed the methodology that would not disclose it is irrelevant to your obligation under 26G. You have to do what you have to do.
Okay.
It would be unethical, on the other hand, to mislead your opponent and having, in my view, gathered the information, not saying anything at all, because you know that if your opponent persists in the keywords, he will never find it. I suppose I could get an argument from those who interpret the lawyer's obligations during negotiations much differently than I do. But poor Maura has had the misfortune to hear me talk about these issues, and I believe that fundamental honesty is and should be the ethical rule, and I can't describe that any other way to say it's a very dishonest way to conduct yourself.
Maura, you wanted to add something here.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to something that Judge Grimm said, and I think for our audience, it's helpful to realize there is a trade-off between recall and precision. And I've termed it kind of a slidogram, that you get one at the expense of the other. So, and this goes to back to proportionality, that, you know, we have to look at particular matters, and maybe in one matter it is important to have, you know, 99% recall, even though it's going to lower that precision and it's going to cost 6 times as much or 50 times as much to review the more documents that come in through the sieve. And in another matter, maybe 90% or 85% recall is good enough to lower that cost of review. And I think that needs to be taken into account. It's not just one or the other.
So it has to be balanced. It has to be balanced,
yep.
It seems to me, Maura, on the what's the alternative. And if the alternative is eyeball on review, and that is significantly less likely to have a recall rate that even gets near 80%, that's
right.
The battle I've never seen joined. Is
right.
That there seems to be this assumption that if you're arguing between 80 and 90% recall and one instance being justified versus the other, then the question that the proponent of the 80 who's being told, no, it has to be 90, should be prepared to join and have the court rule on is the alternative to not doing it this way
right.
Is showing that the eyeballs on method, which is the preferred method that a lot of people knee-jerk think is there, is going to be more accurate, and it's not.
Right, and that's what Gordon Cormack and I are trying to show in this first study that we were honored that you and Judge Facciola reviewed, that is clearly not the case. It certainly in certain circumstances can do well, but across the boards, many of these tools actually surpass human eyeballs.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. Chris, in the UK, used a different approach for e-discovery, and we did an entire show on that topic in about 35 minutes. But to summarize, your system revolves around having to disclose the information, adverse or supportive, as it relates to the pleadings, as opposed to the relevancy without the discovery requests involved. It's just the rule you have to produce this information. Does or can clustering aid in that approach, and why?
Firstly, it's a major difference between the two systems that the giver of documents initiates the process here, decides what the rules and what proportionality require him or her to give disclosure of, which in a sense gets us off the ethical issue that Judge Facciola has just talked about, because the burden is always with the giver anyway. So the question whether your opponent's keywords or whatever has hit that target is an irrelevant one. Clustering anything which allows you to get your arms around what you've got and what is the body of potentially disclosable documents that you hold has to be better than pretending that you're, we're back in paper days and you went into a room and pulled out files. You can't do that anymore. You have to have, with any appreciable volume, some means of bucketing this stuff so that the lawyers can begin to see what they've got. So the answer to your question is yes, clustering has an extremely valuable use in UK disclosure as it does in US discovery.
So more in a nutshell, isn't the problem partly that we're tied to a system which has the parties requesting or agreeing on keywords that meet and confers? Do you see any middle ground on using these approaches today?
Well, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with keywords per se, and if you can sit down with your opposing party and come up with a list and do testing and tweaking of it, certainly that can work in some circumstances. The problem is we don't always know what words people use, what the documents are going to say, and some of these other technologies can actually give you a handle when you don't have the opportunity to speak to custodians who created the documents or you don't exactly know in an investigation what you're looking for. So I think the key in a nutshell is being competent in knowing what the alternatives are out there and using the right one under the right circumstances.
It's almost a byproduct, isn't it, of clustering, that it gives you a list of all the words that exist that allows you then that informs your discussions about your own discussions and your discussions with opponents about keywords, because you've been given a list of those words that recur.
Right, and you can also get that from just asking your vendor for an index. You know, after they've indexed the data, to give you a list of all the words that appear from, you know, most frequent to least frequent, and that can be helpful because you can come across misspellings and other words you didn't anticipate. But I think one of the things we found in Trek is that hybrid approaches work best. It's not that there's one method that works the best in every circumstance, but there are lots of different methods that work in combination successfully.
So how do you work with the other party? Because, you know, Sedona Conference and many others have been pushing cooperation. You know, what types of issues can you run into when you're talking to the other side saying this is how we want to do it?
Is that directed to me?
Sure,
I think part of it is not everybody is up to speed on all of these different tools. And there's a lot of distrust out there. At this point, and one of the things we found also in Trek is not all of these tools are created equal. And there's no, at this point, consumer's guide you can pull off your shelf and look up this one versus that one. So, you know, that's a problem. I know Jason Barron and I and some others have been talking about maybe some kind of certification entity where at least certain tools could get a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and then I think it would make it easier to negotiate with opposing counsel or with a regulator if you wanted to use one of them. But right now you're met with a lot of suspicion and distrust and fear and concern about using them.
And Judge Grimm and or Judge Facciola, do you have a reaction to this sort of distrust issue? I mean, is that the time to call in the judge, or is it the time to punt and just go back to what we always do?
John, why don't you go first on that, and then I'll chime in.
Well, the alternative would be, let's assume one side cannot convince the other side of the validity of an approach other than keywording, and then there is a dispute about keywording. There are already cases, this year in Arkansas, in which the judge got in at a very granular level, you know, on assessing the likelihood that a particular word would be reasonable and whether the objection to the use of that word or to only the use of that word was a reasonable. That discussion, which if not informed by an alternative, strikes me as a glorious waste of everyone's time if we are all agreed that the keyword search is going to yield much more than anyone needs and that it's only going to send us back to the drawing board. So to answer your question, it would seem to me that if you are going to invoke the judicial intervention, you might want to invoke it by taking the position that if we continue to argue about keywords, we're going nowhere. We've got this other approach, Your Honor. Our opponent will not listen to it. Would you listen to us in a conference? My own feeling is that most judges would welcome that, there is nothing about keyword searching that, you know, philosophically or idealistically is so obviously correct that a judge would say, well, that's the way we have to do it. I find that inconceivable. I think it's just more likely that this is the way the parties have done it, and my intervention is sought to see if what they've done is reasonable. Now, the problem is the more you educate the judiciary, the more the judiciary says, well, why are we doing it this way at all?
This is Paul Grimm. I agree with what John said, but it comes back to what I call the information inertia. It's that the lawyers who are the ones who go into court, the litigators, unless you have someone like Morrow, or unless you're dealing with a government agency that has counsel like Jason Barron, and you're dealing with people who actually know the technical aspects of what they're talking about, what you get is you get information intermediaries. You get the trial lawyers who talk to a technical person, and they sponsor an approach. They then come into court. They don't know it, so their depth of knowledge is very shallow, and they explain it. They grab a court at a time when the court has not been given information beforehand to be able to study it and make an informed decision on its own. And the process of resolution, as John just said, because no one has offered up, is doomed to failure from the very beginning. We need to start with the assumption that technology is always going to outpace, constantly outpace, the ability of the law and the lawyers to be able to come up with the latest, greatest thing. And what we know is these issues associated with concept searching and clustering and methods of marshaling information, we know that there is a vast need for these approaches that have nothing to do with litigation, that has everything to do with the way in which commerce is conducted and will be conducted. And so the market is going to deliver ever-changing methods of doing that. Now, Moore's point is, in my mind, extremely important. Because what happens is if you go online and do a Google search, I haven't done this, I should have thought to do it beforehand, and you just Google computer search methodology, my guess is you're going to have so many hits that would come up of competing claims and no method of verifying the accuracy of claims. So what ends up happening is that there's information overload, and so no one has any idea how to rank this and to decide how to use it and how to approach it. So what that does then is it makes people fall prey to people who may have a product that they want to sell that may or may not perform as advertised, and they then use the fear-mongering in terms of the lack of technical information to be able to evaluate the precision, recall, accuracy, reliability issues that come up. And what really almost needs to happen is there must be an independent clearinghouse, kind of like an underwriter laboratories thing, to be able to try and establish minimum criteria for performance-based use of some of these things, and that can be established in a way that if it has been tried, true, and used and proven, that you can get some sort of, okay, that program that we know will work, and we can use that until the next thing comes around, and some sort of a process of being able to show that that is something that works well enough to be able to use. And in the meantime, we're going to constantly always be finally coming up with broad concepts that say things like, well, these are methods that we should use, but not details about how they actually operate to make informed choices, like John says, between discrete proposals.
Yeah, and this is Facciola again. I have a question for Chris and Moore and you, Carl.
Okay.
And it's always troubled me that we look for methodologies independent of what the business is itself doing. I mean, Paul and I would assume that gigantic companies must have their own internal resources so that when Mrs. Smith calls and she makes an inquiry as to why she got a late notice of insurance premium that she in fact paid, they must have a methodology to instantaneously find that information in a massive database. And one of the things I frankly don't understand, because I am not in the private sector and not working with those corporations, is don't they already have in existence methodologies that search gigantic amounts of information to find what they need?
You know, I'm going to throw out a quick answer, because when I was doing the training that you were participating on with Western District a month ago, Judge Facciola, one of the attorneys listening in emailed me and said, auto companies today already use methodologies, including concept clustering, to find problems out in the world with people complaining about their vehicles.
Yeah.
So they're using these types of tools in a business setting to try to get their arms around what's happening in the marketplace.
Well, Carl, this is Paul Grimm. What happens if you go online and order something from Amazon? The next time you log on to Amazon, they've got a half a dozen suggestions of things that they're just sure that you want to order based upon the way that they had their old, you know, business system set up to be able to look at what you looked at before and make those decisions. I mean, that stuff is out there.
Yeah.
Sorry, both those illustrations illustrate the point I made at the beginning, that unlike most database-type searches, of which the two you've just given are examples, the lawyer approaching his discovery obligations doesn't know what is in there at all, which is a very different concept from knowing whether Mrs. Smith made a call about a particular thing or the Amazon example. Yes, companies do have very large data systems, but the sophistication that lies in so much of this e-disclosure software is streets ahead of most internal database management systems. When your problem is what have I got here, as opposed to what is the answer to this particular question.
I'd have to agree with Chris that many of the companies, not all of them, but many of the companies that I work with really don't have a good grip on what it is they have and how to find it, and don't have good enterprise search capability, maybe within a particular database, but not in the loose electronic files or the email.
Yeah, actually, we played that clip in the Southern District with the training we did, Maura, and one of the points I sort of wanted to throw out there is, you know, a team of records managers at very, very large, sophisticated companies made the point that they're overwhelmed by data, and it's more of an art than a science, how they find and select what they store. And that's the beginning of the process. Now we get down to the litigation stage, and we're scrutinizing what's been collected loosely at a very high standard of scrutiny. At least that's what people, lawyers are expecting, to try to figure out if they have the best approaches. It just seems a little weird. But anyway, hey, let's move into predictive coding a little bit, which I'd rather call suggested coding, because machines alone make mistakes, and is more good a test, and Chris as well, and people might want to involve themselves in reviewing some of these results. But this is a field where you actually stop reviewing at a certain point because you have trained the machine on what types of documents you're looking for. And more, we presented to a number of judges in the Southern District of New York last week and reviewed the TREC data. Would you care to share our group's assessments on how all the teams did versus human review studies and how we reached the conclusion?
Well, I think that, you know, the people who were in attendance were suitably surprised that at reviewing 30% of a document set that some of these technologies, and I'm looking at my scorecard here, can get 70, 80, 90% recall at looking at 30% of the documents. And that's a great result, pretty much straight out of the box. Now, like I said,
With what precision?
The precision can vary.
All right, Maura, could you
Yes. Could
you put that? Give us an example of what you mean. All right, this is a class action, and it involves a claim that these companies had cooperated with each other in setting the price of a particular good. And we know that they were both members of the same trade association and had correspondence over the years. That looks like it's a fertile source. Can you explain to us how this technology would look at that data and work predictively?
Okay. All right. So what would happen is, as normal, the documents would be collected, the custodians identified, and the lawyers would look at a sample a random sample, or perhaps it could even be one or two custodians that you know have a high proportion of responsive documents, and you create a seed set or a bunch of exemplars of a range of documents that were truly responsive, right on point. And then those would be fed to this software, and this software learns what you're interested in and goes into the set and finds others that are like that, that may have the same terms, that may have the same structure, that may be in the same time period, that may be between the same custodians. You know, these are complex algorithms, and pulls them back. And you can continue to refine that by having the lawyer look at some of the results that the machine produces and then say, well, no, you didn't quite get it right here. These really I'm not interested in. Those I am. And then again, the tool learns from those distinctions the same way that a spam filter learns over time what spam is and what spam isn't. And then eventually when you're happy enough with the results and the distinctions, you run it through, and the software will then rank those documents from those it predicts as most likely to be responsive and least likely. And then at that point, you can do lots of different things. You can start at the top and have your expensive reviewers do that. You can do sampling at the bottom to make sure there isn't a lot of responsive stuff in that set and pull it out. Or you can have much cheaper offshore reviewers or paralegals or people at much lower rates look at those documents. And the ones in the middle, you can, either decide or not decide, depending on how much money you want to spend, how many of those you want to look through to find stuff that's marginal or on the borderline of responsive or not responsive. So that's how those kinds of technologies work.
I want to add one thing that I thought was pretty interesting, and because Judge Grimm and I have had a number of talks about applying Daubert to this, which is an excellent idea, because that makes it bulletproof. But if you just take anecdotal information and apply it to these 11 results, and compare Blair Maron as an example, which was a study that was done on human review using keyword searching. All 11 of the entrants in Trek comfortably out surpassed Blair Maron for recall. Wasn't that interesting, Maura? I mean, we focused on that a bit too, I think, as side discussion in that group.
But I think the point is you have to do some quality control on anything you do. You have to do quality control on humans. You have to do quality control on these tools. I mean, I had one matter where we were able to pull out 50% of the documents with a pretty high level of confidence that there was no more than 3% responsive documents that were left behind in that data set. And I would have been perfectly comfortable, given what was at stake in that matter, going before Judge Grimm or going before Judge Facciola and saying, we pulled out this 50% because I know from sampling there's no more than 3% responsive documents in that 50%, and this matter is worth spending, another $200,000 to find that 3%. And that's the kind of ammunition you need to have by doing sampling and testing to go into a court and argue.
Judge, this is Paul Grimm. Let me diagnose this and then let John Facciola give his observations as well. Because if that happened in a court, then what you would have is you would have an attorney who, because as Maura described what she would feel comfortable doing, who understands what is available out there to use in terms of methodology, has selected a methodology, has anticipated the issues that the court's going to have, has had come up with technical answers as to what they are, and in the face of what she can expect her adversary to say, which is, I want it all, has done a particularized assessment to show why what she says is proportional and why that's appropriate under Rule 26G and 26B2C. If John Facciola or I or any of the other colleagues I know had that kind of debate before us to decide, we'd be ecstatic. Because we would have the kind of information that we can then double down on and make a principled decision. The problem is that the side is you too seldom have a situation where you're presented with that level of information or that has a technical basis for being able to argue, call it Daubert or call it anything else, that this is what you should do. And if that were happening, I think you would find a lot more of the decisions out there that suggest that this is exactly the kind of experimentation that ought to take place.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, and I think another thing we really haven't emphasized that we should is, I don't know how it can legitimately be said that manual review of certain data sets is, in fact, can be accomplished in the world in which we live. There are certain data sets which I would say cannot be done in the time that we have as simply a matter of arithmetic. So the question then becomes, what is the best methodology to do that? And this methodology is so much more preferable to keyword searching. I don't know what kind of argument could be made by the person who would say keyword searching would suffice as opposed to this sophisticated analysis. I mean, that's just comparing two things that can't legitimately be compared, because one is a bold guess as to what the significance of a particular word, while the other is a scientific analysis of that is accompanied by a methodology that will meet the test of Daubert or of any other standard by which one tests a scientific methodology. The point I'm trying to make, and for example, I was reading yesterday in the New York Times, the magazine was devoted to the ideas in the 2010, was pointing out how social science research is simply being overwhelmed by the available data and how it's changing, and how Facebook has become an extraordinarily important source of social science data. There are, believe it or not, even analyses that relate the tenor of what is being said to people on Facebook and movement in the stock market. And that kind of data sets, those kind of data sets are the data sets that we are now engaged in. And I don't know how you make the argument to search them other than the way that Maura just stated. I mean, it's just a devastating argument. It doesn't have an answer.
Chris,
Judge, can we use keywords? Can we use Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones because they were custodians? In light of what Maura said, that would be greeted by most judges, I suppose, with laughter.
Well, Chris, there was an interesting case you brought to my attention in England, the Goodale case, which you sent to me. You care to speak just a little bit about it and why it's significant?
Yes, I'll go back a bit first, if I may. We have a new practice direction here, which this is addressing the last point, really, which in the inappropriate cases requires the parties to discuss before the case management conference various aspects, including specifically limiting disclosure of documents to certain categories or custodians or whatever, the use of keyword searches, agreed keyword searches, and the use of agreed software tools. So it's implicit in that the parties will sit down and discuss what type of technology they intend to use to produce a proportionate search. That opens the implication, and bear in mind this is new, this practice direction, that a party who proposed to use technology of the sort that we've been talking about and who's done their own exercise at setting a boundary beyond which, as Maura was putting it, it's not worth going on because the cost outstrips the value, of bringing their opponent or inviting their opponent round and saying, come and have a look at what we're proposing to do here. Take some samples if you care to. They can do all this without prejudice, if you like, so they don't, if anything accidentally emerges, they're covered. But effectively make your opponent complicit in what you're intending to do. The same practice direction also requires parties to give the judge two bits of paper. One, those things they have agreed, and the other, those things they have not, which could also set out what attempts have been made to persuade the other party. So there's a framework whose efficacy we have yet to test, which would go some way, I think, towards narrowing the gap where one party is technologically skilled and another one may be willing to learn but doesn't have the skills before he starts. The Goodale case that you referred to was a case heard by Senior Master Whittaker, who's well known in the US now. It involved one party who said, a claimant who said, you must disclose everything, and a defendant who said, we do not intend to disclose electronic documents because it is disproportionate to do so, a bland, it's all too disproportionate. At the case management conference, the master said that this was both approaches were nonsense, and was it not possible to identify the custodians that mattered, and the claimants readily identify when put to it like that, which of the defendant's custodians they were interested in. And Master Whittaker said, right, let's start from there, just those four. We may go further in due course, but let's start from there. And he then went on, and this is where it becomes, we come back into the technology aspects of it. He then went on to say, this is a case where technology ought to be used. And specifically, he said, because we need to cut the expense of review. He said, when it comes to review, I am aware of software that will effectively score each document as to its likely relevance and which will enable a prioritization of categories within the entire document set. He didn't order that it be used, but he made it clear that he thought that an appropriate method in principle for very large population, document populations to be reduced to what he called a manageable corpus for human review. So those three elements, right? The practice direction saying everybody must talk to each other, including about the use of specific software tools and of data sampling. The who matters here? Let's start from them and work outwards point. And thirdly, it's appropriate in the right case to use software of the kind that we've been talking about, that which will score document relevance as a means of reducing the population. That case I have described as a template, a model for judicial management of cases.
This is Paul Grimm saying I'm going to sign off now, wishing everybody happy holidays and good concept searching.
Great.
Merry Christmas, Paul.
Thank you.
Happy Christmas.
We've actually gotten through most of the questions here, and I just had a couple of questions from attorneys that specifically were curious, and I think we've answered a lot of them as well. But, you know, Judge Facciola, while you're still on, if I could just ask you, you know, one of the things that's associated with this is error. You're always going to have error, even with the, you know, especially with the new technology, I mean, with any type of review. So, you know, is it appropriate to have some level of error given, you know, the error rates that are associated with human review?
I think it depends on what the lawsuit is all about. I might be willing to tolerate a particular level of error in a commercial transaction or litigation that would be intolerable in a criminal action where we are searching for evidence that would tend to exculpate the defendant. So I don't think you can answer that question abstractly. Again, it's a question of what's at stake. And it's hard to imagine a criminal case in which conceptual searching would still leave exculpatory material behind of which the defendant was unaware, but one would at least have to think about it. But in terms of confronting the question of error, to me the biggest problem as a judge is convincing myself in the depth of my conscience that I shouldn't take at least one more step, even though Mora has convinced me that that one step is not going to be terribly productive. So to answer your question, I'm not there yet. I have to understand the nature of the error and the potential it would have for changing the result that would occur in this case. I can't answer the question of abstractly whether there's going to be error. Of course, since we're not angels and human beings, there's always going to be error. But what level of error is tolerable is lost in the wilderness of the facts of that case.
And do you have any advice to the attorneys who say they want to use cost-saving concept searching methods for review, but they're afraid to do so before there's any specific case authority to support that approach?
What can I tell them? I mean, I would hope they will meet a responsive judiciary and that the economics of the position they're in will drive them to that result, because the client cannot possibly bear doing it any other way. And just to have the courage to do it, I'm growing more and more convinced on every day as I read more opinions, meet more judges, that that there are more and more judges who are anxious to get into this field and who, quotes, get it. Certainly my training, my most recent training of the new magistrate judges filled me with great amount of promise and hope for the future, given the level of the discussions we had and the fact that they have been involved in these issues, whether they were in their experience before becoming judges. So I can only, use the old Italian word, coraggio. Somebody's got to have the courage to go first, and judges have to have it, and lawyers have to have it, too.
And I'm going to just do one more here. I think we answered most of these, actually, but this is, I thought, a pretty good one, because this was an attorney that said, you know, what if one party wants to use concept tools to reduce their data sets prior to review and the other side won't agree to it? We talked about going in and get the judiciary to back that up, but we didn't talk about levels of disclosure necessary to back it up. And this attorney came up with a couple of examples, you know. One, maybe showing any and all concepts being excluded and identifying the concepts being included. You know, that's one possibility, or providing a sample.
I think what you want to do, I think, I don't know if Moore and Chris agree, but rather than just, you know, a couple of pot shots, I think you want a sophisticated approach. And if you're going to be the first one, it may be a very good idea to clothe it in the potential testimony of someone who truly knows what they are doing. That is a very good way to educate a judge. Judges love to be educated by people who know what they're talking about and who have taken the time to write a principled and comprehensible and understandable submission.
That's submission, if I can come in there. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm going to dub both of you special masters, because North Judge Fisher in the Western District's pushing a special master program here, and she said, one of the reasons is to maybe appoint special masters, or good use of this tool, who understand the technical area of search, who can help guide the parties. So let's pretend you're both special masters now. How would you react to this? Now you're in the judiciary side helping out. Do you feel like you could get comfortable?
I'm sorry, Judge Hachero, I thought you'd finished and I cut you off there. The point I was going to make is that that's only half of the equation, the technical information necessary to understand what's being said here. The other part, and a vital part, is what are the cost implications of going one way mm-hmm. rather than the other, mm-hmm. With estimates and, for example, if taking a particular route is going to add 100,000 documents to the set, that has a cost implication that has to be weighed. And that's as equally an important component, I think, in the balancing exercise that is, in fact, the other half of what proportionality is. We've had too many people over here who say, oh, it's all too expensive to use this technology, without having the first idea what either route is going to cost them, their traditional route or a modern technology route. So the answer to your question, Carl, is I would require people to be able to say what the cost implications are of the route that they are proposing. And in general, the burden must pass to the one who argues for the more expensive route.
Right.
Very well put, Chris. Extremely well put.
Go ahead, Maura.
I was going to say, the other thing I think we have to start focusing on, and I know I've heard Judge Facciola talk about this and others, we, in a trial, maybe there are 100 exhibits, if that, that really matter. And right now we're spending huge amounts of time and money looking at documents that are maybe perhaps technically responsive, but have nothing to do whatsoever with resolving the dispute. And I think we're getting to the point where, one of the things we see in Trek is it's almost impossible to get any two reviewers to agree on those marginally relevant documents, because on different days they'll see them differently, and they're so unimportant that people can go either way. We've got to stop spending time and money focusing on the zillions of documents that shed no light on the dispute, and figure out ways to focus on the documents that matter, that smaller corpus that are actually going to resolve the dispute.
That's also an excellent point. This has been, I think, very, very helpful, and somehow we managed to get this done in under an hour. I didn't think it was going to be possible. So congratulations on succinctly making points, all of you, and Judge Grimm as well, who's no longer on the call. But I want to thank Judge Grimm and Judge Facciola, and Chris Dale and Maura Grossman for joining us on another ESI Bytes show. It's always a pleasure to have each of you share your knowledge with us and your listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. You can remember our show phonetically as it sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.